We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name's Richie. My sobriety date is the 5th of May, 2018. I'll start at the beginning. So I'm from a place called Washington, which is in the northeast of England. And it's where George Washington's family were from originally before they moved to America. I've got a sister and I've got a mum and dad, and throughout my childhood, I didn't have a bad upbringing, but from being about 11 year old, I always found like I was a bit of an outsider. I was a bit of a loner, and I didn't really have close friends as such. And part of that reason was I was very sporty. So I played a lot of sport, and I was very good at football, English football, so soccer in America. When I went to school, I was quite academic, so I was quite brainy. I passed all exams quite comfortably, and because of this, I was put in what was classed as like express classes. So it was for the brighter pupils of the school. Now, because I played a lot of sport, but then I was in classes with sort of the cleverer kids, there was no mix. There was no mix of people. I was the only one that done that. So I didn't really felt like I belonged to any group or have any sort of friends, like a friendship group as such, and kind of just flitted around from group to group. There was a few problems with my childhood. As in, like, my mum and dad argued quite a bit. My dad would go missing for a few days or a night, and then we'd just return. It would all turn back to normal. And I can always remember that. I always used to want to run away, and I always had a backpack that I hid in my room for when this time came and I was going to run away from it all when my mum and dad were arguing. But apart from that, it wasn't too bad, you know. My mum and dad loved us a lot and they'd done a lot for us. There was no sort of abuse or anything like that. So I kind of felt quite lucky with my childhood. When I was 14, 15, I was, like I said, I excelled at football and started playing football for a professional team in England. And when I left school, I got offered a contract. So I signed for a professional football club. And it's all I wanted to do since I was 5 year old, really, was play football. And it was kind of a dream come true. And at this point, I'd met a girl as well and got into a relationship. And that was great. I started playing football when I left school and done quite well in my first year. Played a lot of games and was getting highly thought of and spoke about, and it was good, and I felt okay. What I would say at this point, I had to travel, so I either had to travel 45 minutes on a bus or travel half an hour on a train and then a bit more on a bus. So I decided to do like the train and bus idea because there was other lads doing that, and because I'd never really felt like I belonged to anybody. I didn't really want to be sitting on a bus on my own and just travelling on my own all the time. So I decided to go and meet these other lads in Newcastle and get the train to football every day. Now at the train stations in England, there's always like bandits and one-armed bandits and stuff like that. And that kind of got a hold of us a little bit, and I always found myself playing on these bandits at train stations, and that was kind of my start of my gambling, really. Every day basically just using money that I had to play on these bandits. And it wasn't a problem. It was just something to do while we waited for the train. As I went into my second year of football and I was coming up to 17, I was 17, I got injured on a... So my first ever night out, it was somebody's 18th birthday and we went to a town, and because we were footballers, we sort of looked at in a different way to everybody else. You know, there was a lot of jealousy about, there was a lot of people that like kind of wanted to get their own back on us a little bit for whatever reason, and we ended up in a fight, and from that fight I ended up with a broken jaw, and I couldn't play football. So at the time I was just training a lot, and what I would say at this point is I realised that when I had football in my life, or when I was playing sport, which is where I felt comfortable and was good, I always felt at ease. I always felt that my life was on track and I was succeeding, and I felt comfortable with myself and who I was. When I got this injury, I realised that I couldn't really deal with the feelings and emotions very well, and obviously I was fighting them. And the gamble and the playing on the bandits turned into going into the bookies, and I felt that I found that when I went in the bookies, you know, I forgot about all of the stuff that was going on in the real world, and it just took my mind away from stuff. And obviously I had a few wins and got a kind of a hit of dopamine from betting. That became my escape for a period of time. At the same time, round about the same time, so I wasn't playing football. I was still on a contract, but I wasn't playing. I was injured, so I was doing a lot of training in the gym and then spending a lot of time in the bookies. My girlfriend was, we found out my girlfriend was pregnant, so I was quite young, and she was quite young, 17, and we went on this roller coaster ride of emotions, and like I just said, I couldn't deal with emotions very well, and it was like, how do we tell parents? How do we tell people about this? We're too young, and all this sort of stuff, and then we decided after about 20 weeks that we were going to tell everybody, and we were loved. We were asked about how it happened and all that sort of stuff, and why, and if we wanted to keep the baby and stuff, and we did. We wanted to keep it. And then it all became nice and rosy after that, and it was everybody looking at the positives and buying stuff for the baby and looking for somewhere to live together and all of these things. And at the same time, though, I still wasn't playing football, and I was struggling with that. And football was kind of a release for us as well. And during this time, the gambling was getting worse. I hardly ever drank. I mean, I drank on the night out when we had a fight, but I didn't drink much at all. And anyway, it come to the end of that season, and I still had a year left on my contract, but I was really disheartened with football, and I was thinking I wanted to do something else with my life, and I had this child on the way, so I wanted to go and get an education, and so I could have a better career for my child, because the football was hit-y-miss whether it was going to work out. So I left football, and that was like a massive decision for me. I think I lacked massive self-belief, and I never thought that I was quite good enough for anything in life, and I never thought I would be quite good enough to earn a lot of money from football, really. And I kind of jumped ship. And again, it was back to that when I was a kid, you know, wanting to run away. And it was the same sort of feeling as I was getting then, was just run away from this mess, you know, and you can have a better future. So anyway, I did, and we come to an agreement that if I stayed in education, then I would still get looked after as such in terms of some financial support and stuff. So I signed up and went to university. Now, a couple of months after that, so that started in the September, and come the end of October, I got a phone call like 6 o'clock in the morning, and my girlfriend had been rushed to hospital, and she was very early in terms of the pregnancy, you know, and she gave birth to a little boy. But during the birth, Dylan, as he was called, he caught an infection. And unfortunately he died. So I was 18 years old, and I was in this hospital, and I didn't know what was going on, really. All these emotions we'd had over the past 30 odd weeks was hard for me to deal with. And I was running away to the bookies as a form of coping mechanism, really. And after that, the gambling just got really, really bad. I didn't deal with grief. I didn't deal with any of the emotions that were attached to that. I didn't even acknowledge half of the time that it had happened. And my girlfriend struggled as well at the time, and she didn't cope, and that kind of forced us into not being there for each other as such, and not knowing how to deal with it. When I started university, obviously part of the university scene and going to university is going out on the drink, meeting people, partying and all that sort of stuff. And that's what I started doing. And I got a job in a gym, and I was working in a gym as well while I was at university. So I had a bit of income, and I just found that every penny I had was going in the bookies. And then on a weekend, I was playing like semi-professional football at this time and still getting paid. And on a weekend, I'd go to football on a Saturday and get paid. And that money would either go in the bookies or I would go on a night out. And that was when I started drinking a bit more excessively. And what I found is every time I went out on a night out, I drank in excess, drank to blackout, drank, never wanted to go home. And this was as soon as I started drinking regularly, really. And it was like on a weekend, really. And then off the back of that, I was introduced to like recreational drugs, cocaine, ecstasy, MDMA, ketamine, all these sorts of party drugs, as such as what we called them back then. And I started using them just every now and again, and it was never a problem. But what was a problem was me gambling. My gambling was getting worse and worse. So as I went through university, I realised that I needed more money, and I needed more money to gamble. So the easiest thing for me to do was to start sort of selling drugs a little bit and making a little bit of money off that, because everybody wanted them and everybody was using it. And I didn't do it to any massive scale, but I'd done it just within close circles of friends. And yeah, that went on for a good few years. And then something happened on a night out, and I kind of got caught doing that. And anyway, that put an end to that. And I decided at about 21, 22 years old, I was going to stop doing that. But when I stopped doing that, I started using drugs more. And that became a bit more of a regular thing. And it was kind of most Fridays and most Saturday nights, along with drinking alcohol. And Monday to Thursday, I would be in the bookies gambling. And then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I'd be drinking alcohol and using mainly ecstasy or cocaine. And that was horrible. It was a period of my life where I had no worth. I had no self-worth. I really struggled to deal with everything. And I just looked for a way of escaping all of the time. And that was fine. You know, that was fine. That was my way of dealing with it, really, and my way of dealing with life. And this went on for all of my early 20s. When I was about 25, I got offered a job in Manchester, which is a different part of the UK. And I moved away, thinking that that would help us get a grip on everything that was happening. And it didn't really. It just got worse. I started earning more money at that point, and I thought that would be me saviour to starting a new life and getting over, especially my gambling addiction mainly. because at this point I still didn't really realise I had a problem with drinking drugs. But Manchester is a bit of a party place as well, and I was quickly drawn into that party scene and done partying during the week and stuff like that as well, which was new for me. It obviously increased my alcohol usage and also increased my drug usage at the same time, but still I couldn't admit, I hadn't even seen that it was a problem. So I worked in Manchester for a few years and then decided it was time to come back home. Throughout this time, every time I went out, I would drink, and then every time I would be paralytic, I would be mortal drunk, I would be drinking to blackout, drinking, always looking for a party, always looking for that something extra, that something more, that next thing. I tried a few times at this point to stop gambling, and I'd had counselling a couple of times and stuff, but it never really worked for any sort of length of time. You know, there was periods of abstinence for a few months at a time, 6 months. So I came back home to the northeast of England at 27, 28 year old, and I thought I'm going to try and get a grip on my gambling. So I went to counselling again, and it was a bit more successful this time, but I still had the same issue, you know. I still had the same issue, and the issue being I couldn't deal with my emotions, I couldn't deal with my feelings. So all I wanted to do, whatever, was suppress them, suppress my feelings any way I could, and gambling done that for us, alcohol done that for us, and using drugs done that for us. And as I stopped trying to gamble, I found myself using alcohol much, much more. And I'd basically swapped one thing for another. And the gambling had went from gambling every day to not at all, really, for long periods. But the alcohol went from being a Friday and a Saturday, Sunday thing to a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then it was a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And eventually I was drinking quite regular. But I still never seen it as a problem. I was doing it with other people, and I always found that was my excuse. You know, I'm not the only one doing this, so it can't really be a problem. But what I hadn't realised was that on a Friday, I would do it with one group of friends, and the Saturday, I'd do it with a different group of friends, and the Sunday, I'd do it with a third group of friends. And I was the only constant. I was the only one that was doing it all of the time. But I didn't really see it at the time. This is all in hindsight. I didn't see it happening at all. I met a new partner when I come back to the Northeast, and she ended up pregnant, and we were overjoyed, really, and really looking forward to it. But this was 10 years after I'd lost my first son, and I was petrified. I was really, really scared. She'd had, this was like the third pregnancy that she'd had, and she'd had two miscarriages before that. So obviously you think the worst, and you just think it's going to be more heartache, you know, and I still couldn't deal with feelings and emotions, and that led us to using alcohol and drugs, excessive amounts, especially on a weekend. I've always been able to continue working throughout my whole life, really, and the reason I think that is because that fed me addiction. You know, that ability to earn money meant I could always have money to gamble, to drink, to use drugs. Even though I was taking out loans and I was getting into debt, at 28, I ended up with £97,800 worth of debt off it all, and that's like astronomical amount of money, really. And I'd lost 5-6 times more than that through gambling and drugs and stuff. But I still didn't really stop. My first son come along, and I thought that would be the point where my life changed, and I would stop being this responsible adult to be totally honest, it sent us the other way. I felt like I had more pressure and more stress put on us through this period of time, and it was difficult. I obviously turned to the drinking drugs to help me deal with my emotions. Even though I wasn't dealing with them, I was just suppressing them and running away from them. And it was a common thing, you know. Since I was a teenager, that's what I wanted to do. I always wanted to run away. I just found other places to run to. And I see a lot of the time with me gambling, and once the debt was building, from about 27, I started having suicidal thoughts, and I always fantasized about the way I would kill myself. And we've got quite a famous bridge called the Tyne Bridge in Newcastle, and I'd always fantasized about throwing myself off that bridge. And that went on for a few years. Even when my son came along, and I always thought that would be my way out, you know. When it got too tough, that's what I would do. And it was planted in my head. A couple of years later, the relationship was never great. It was never a strong relationship, all down to my addictions and my behaviour and the way that I try to handle things. But a year later, my partner got pregnant again, and we had another little boy. So I've got two boys, and in both times I thought they would be the things that were the reason why I needed to change, but I never knew how to change. You know, I knew I had a problem, especially with the gambling, but I didn't know how to change. And the gambling, I kept having long periods of abstinence, but then I would have a big relapse. And every time I had a relapse, I would lose more money. And this was the predicament I was in. You know, it was a cycle, and I would lose money during the week gambling, and then I would try and drown my sorrows on the weekend with alcohol and drugs. And if I'd lose money on a Tuesday, I'd turn to the drink and drugs on a Tuesday night to forget about the loss. And it all fed into each other. Once I started getting into more debt through drugs, and I was then trying to win money to pay off drug dealers and feed me alcohol and all them sorts of things. But as we know it, it just never happens. You know, you never get yourself out of that hole that you find yourself in. And it's horrible, really. I say it's horrible, but since I've had a chance to look back at it, I firmly believe me running to the drink and drugs saved my life to a point, because it allowed us to escape my own head. It allowed us to forget about the other troubles, the financial troubles and everything that was going on because of the gambling. And it calmed my mind about suicidal thoughts and stuff like that to a certain point. And I firmly believe that's why I turned to the drinking drugs. It's obviously not healthy and it's not great, but I do think it saved my life when I was in my late 20s and going into my 30s. Obviously, everything I've done, I've always done to excess, so the drinking drugs were no different. And it was mainly cocaine. Now I was just fixed on this cocaine all the time. And every time I would have cocaine, I would drink alcohol. And every time I drank alcohol, I'd have cocaine. And the two just went hand in hand. And I never thought, I still didn't see it as a problem. I still openly admit I had a gambling problem. And because I'd done that, it gave us a label as such to hide behind. If I was out getting into more debt, it was because of gambling. If I owed people money, it was because of gambling. And most of the time it wasn't. It was through cocaine, basically. But I could use the gambling to get some help off friends and family and stuff to pay for stuff. But yeah, that it was difficult. My kids are 7 and 5 now, and when my youngest son had turned 2, I had a massive relapse gambling. I hadn't been gambling for about 9 months. And then I had a big relapse. And it was at this point where I wanted out. You know, I couldn't face it. You know, my partner was trying to help us. Everyone was trying to help us. I just felt I'd let everybody down again. And I went, I walked across the Tyne Bridge, which is the bridge I'd always fantasized about. And I stood there crying my eyes out, crying and crying and crying. And this was my rock bottom, really. It was the time when I just didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to be on the planet, you know, and I had these two young kids and there still wasn't enough. It still wasn't enough to keep us here. And I was standing on the bridge crying my eyes out, and just a total random person, total random lady come and spoke to us and said, I look distressed and could you help us? And I just burst out crying and just started telling her I wanted to die. And it was awful. It was an awful experience. But she stood there with us and she said, like, let's go for a walk. Do you mind talking to us? And I don't think I had the bottle to throw myself off that bridge, if I'm truthfully honest. But this person reached out and offered sort of some support and well, just someone to talk to and someone to share. And she said something was on that bridge. And she said, your life might be difficult now and you might want to die now, but you probably don't want to die forever. And if you throw yourself off the bridge, that's what will happen. And that's stuck with us since then, you know. And people go through difficult times and pain, and we all experience pain in our lives because it's just part of life. But the suffering's something that we inflict on ourselves, really. And there's a different way. We don't have to suffer. And after that woman had done that, you know, I went home that day and I rang a rehab centre. Because I used to play football, there's a rehab centre in the UK called Sport and Chance, which was set up by a professional footballer, an ex-professional footballer called Tony Adams, who was captain of England and had an alcohol problem. And I rang that rehab centre and got in touch with them, and that was the start of my recovery and acknowledging all of my problems, so all of my addictions as such. 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, I checked into the rehab centre. And on day one, we sat down and had a little talk. And I was like, oh, I've just got a problem with gambling. Because it was the big relapse that kind of sent us to the Tyne Bridge. So I was sitting there just saying, oh, my problems with gambling. And that's what I need to get a grip on. If I get a grip on that, then everything else will be okay in my life. And one of the counsellors, both of the counsellors that were there had been through 12-step recovery program and obviously had a lot of experience. And after the first little chat that we had, one of the counsellors took them to one side and he asked us loads of questions about alcohol and drugs and how they'd impacted my life and how often I'd done them and did they cause us problems and did they cause us financial worry and did they call us on all these things. And I just kept saying, yes, 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 yes. You know, have you been in trouble with the police? Have you been in a cell? Have you been in hospital? And I just kept saying yes to everything, you know, and everything he asked us, I was like, yes. And he said, well, do you think alcohol and drugs might be a bit of a problem as well? And I said, oh, definitely. You know, it was the light bulb moment as such that I didn't have a problem with gambling. I had a problem with addiction. And all of these things were just coping mechanisms for me to deal with life and to run away from my feelings. So anytime I was presented with anything, good or bad, I would just run away to these three things. I was in rehab for 28 days and we had therapy every 2-3 times a day and we'd done lots of different stuff, and it was a foundation for me to start looking at my life in a different way. We were introduced to 12-step recovery. We went there. Gamblers Anonymous, we went to Alcoholics Anonymous, we went to Narcotics Anonymous, and we went to Cocaine Anonymous, and we tried all these different meetings, and it was in a different part of the country to where I live, and I wasn't sure how I would feel about going to meetings once I got back home, but over the 28 days, I found that they were really helpful, and I got I found a lot of similarities between my story and everybody else's, and we were given all the basic advice, you know, and look for the similarities, you know, take it one day at a time and do the work, really. I left rehab which was kind of a bubble. It wasn't really the real world, but it was a good foundation and it had taught us a lot. And I was told once I get out of rehab, go and do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I was quite lucky that in the northeast of England, there was 120, 130 meetings a week that I could attend. So 90 meetings in 90 days was the advice. And obviously being a little bit of an addict, basically I'd done over 100 meetings in the first 90 days. And recovery became my new focus and became the thing that I started to do a lot of. My partner who'd supported us through all this, we decided that would be a good idea to have some counselling therapy, like couples therapy. And we went there, and my partner was a bit codependent as well, and the counsellor told her that she needed to detach a little bit. And I started doing this recovery and working on myself, and my partner started listening to what the counsellor said and doing her own bit of work, and she was told to detach a little bit, and she detached completely. And that was difficult because I was trying to make amends, and I thought I would come out of this rehab centre and life would be perfect, you know, and life would be rosy and we'd get along great, and all of the problems that caused loads of shit and loads of heartache in the past were now, in my head, were now going to be fixed. But obviously it isn't that way, you know, life isn't that straightforward. And a lot of problems just continued, some down to her behaviour, some are still down to my behaviour, but it wasn't great. I started getting feelings and I started feeling my emotions and I wasn't running away from them anymore. And through the first 12 months of my sobriety, it was probably the hardest time of my life. And it was hard because I had to sit with feelings and I had to sit with emotions and I had to do what real grown-ups done, and I had to sort out problems and obviously look after my kids and do everything that I should have been doing anyway, but without running away to alcohol, drugs or gambling. It was really, really difficult. My relationship started to break down a little bit, and we were breaking up for a little bit and then thinking, oh, well, we'll fix it, we'll get back together. And that proved to be really difficult. And still is to this day difficult. But I was told if I worked the steps, if I got a sponsor, if I started doing the things that I suggested and started working the program, then things would get better. And I did do that, and a lot of things did get better. But life wasn't easier. I always had this picture of life being much easier, and it wasn't. It wasn't easier. It was probably more difficult because I wasn't running away. It was probably more difficult to deal with my emotions and my feelings than I ever thought possible. But I wasn't running away. I wasn't using it. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't using drugs. I wasn't gambling anymore. And I guess that it's part of the journey, part of my journey anyway. I was about 18 months sober, and like I say, the relationship was on and off all the time. And I'd started, well, I'd been through the steps and I was still doing 10, 11, 12 all the time. And I decided I wanted to go back through the steps again. So I'd done the steps again, and it was probably better for us the second time through than the first time through, if I'm totally honest. And obviously new things had come up. New things had been recalled from my past, but also new things had come up that I was dealing with as well. And I definitely think I got a lot more out of doing the steps the second time through than I did the first. Something I was always struggled with was a lot of people say the obsession to do alcohol, drugs, gambling goes. And I found the obsession was sort of getting weaker. But then I would have like moments of like, oh, I just want to go and get mortal drunk, or I just want to go and use cocaine. And I had them thoughts quite a lot, and I still do get them now. But I just feel now I've got a toolbox of ways of dealing with it, and I do a lot of meditation, and I don't mind the thoughts anymore because I know the thought doesn't instantly change into behaviour, and I don't instantly act out on that thought. I write a journal, I do gratitude, I pray, I meditate daily, every single day. And if I have a period where I feel like I have one of these thoughts, then I'll do one of them things. I've found new hobbies, and I've found new circles of friends that I can talk to, and I can pick up the phone and speak to, and I can pretty much share anything with, and it never shocks them. They're non-judgmental, and I think for me that's so important, to have people who aren't going to judge us for me past, and they're just going to tell us straight. One of the things that was said was when I was in rehab was, oh, I think you'd be really good at counselling. So I signed up, and I'm doing a counselling degree now, and that took my personal development to a whole new level, and it made us look at things in a whole different way. And I've got fantastic recovery from doing 12-step work, and everything I've added on top of that has just given us a lot more sort of quality rather than just time as such. And I've learned a lot more about myself. I've learned loads about myself by doing this degree, and I'm a few months away from completing that, and then obviously I want to be able to give back. Coming from a sporting background, there's a lot of people who struggle with addictions in sport, and I want to be in a position to help them, just like the people in the rehab I went to were in a position to help me. But still, I can't sit here and lie and say that life is really easy. My life is fantastic today. I've got the best relationship with my kids I could ever dream of. And over the past 12 months, obviously, there's been a pandemic, and COVID-19 came, and all the schools got shut, and my work got shut down. And I've ran my own business throughout all of this, and I've managed to keep that going, you know. I've managed to keep it going. Like, I deliver exercise classes to people, and I wasn't able to do that face-to-face, and we found a way, you know. Like, I always used to look for problems. To then run away and say, well, because this has happened, this is why I'm using drinking drugs, or that's happened, so I'll just go and run the boogies. But now I don't. Now I can look for solutions. I can look for solutions, and I can find ways to deal with things. And that's been my biggest gift I'm getting from sobriety, I think, is being able to solve problems rather than create them. And if I continue to solve problems rather than create them, then I know I'll have a better life. And I just, last week I was 1,000 days. I passed 1,000 days, and I can honestly, hand on heart, say all I've done was one day 1,000 times. And sometimes I even done hour by hour, never mind day by day. But I got through it. My life's fantastic now. I've got less than I've ever had in my life in terms of material possessions and cars and houses and money and wages and all that sort of stuff. I've got less now than I've ever had, but I've got so much more peace. I've got so much more joy, so much more happiness. And that just comes from a mindset shift, I think, and being grateful for what I've got. And if I start every day with gratitude, then it puts us on the right foot to having a good day. If problems occur, I can work with people. I can pick up the phone. I can share them, and often find a solution for them. Where in the past it would have been a complete opposite way, and I believe I was my own victim for 20 years of my life, really, and I wanted to be the victim. I wanted to play the victim so that I had an excuse. And I used to always say, if what had happened to me had happened to you, then you'd act the same way as I act, and you'd do the same things that I do. And I now know it was just an excuse. It was an excuse that I told myself so I could run away and not face reality. Today is different. Today is much different. And I'll always continue to do the work that I need to do, and I'll help other people where I can. But ultimately, I need to put myself first in my recovery and make sure that I do the next right thing on a daily basis. And as long as I do the next right thing, I now have faith that my life will be what it's meant to be. And no doubt there will be periods where that are painful for us, but I've just got to know that then periods will pass, and I'll get everything that I deserve if I just continue to do the next right thing. And that's my story, and I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Richie. Why do you think it is that you felt like you never belonged? Do you have any understanding as to why you kind of came with that feeling?
So I always, all my friends would have like, not all my friends, but a lot of people that I hung around with would have a group of people that they would always be in contact with. They would always ring each other. They would always, you'd never see one without the other. They'd be on the phone with each other all the time. And I never had that. I never had that close connection with anybody. I never had that. Until I got into recovery, I never had anybody ring us and ask us how I was or anything like that. And I never really rang anybody else and asked them. And obviously I played a lot of sport, and I went from different teams, and I went traveled around lots of different teams. So I always had a lot of friends, but I never really felt like I had true friends, you know, true friends that would pick up the phone and ring you and just say, how are you doing? I had loads of friends who would ring us and say, shall we go out? Shall we go and get drunk? Shall we go here? Shall we go there? But I never really had friends just to say, how are you? And I think that's why I feel like I never belonged anywhere. And when I was at school, like I said, I never thought I was good enough. I was in classes with very academic, bright kids, and I never thought I was as good as them. And then when I was playing football or playing sport, there was always people that I always thought were better than us, and I never thought I would succeed. And I think it's just an interject that I think I've just picked up of going through life, really. But yeah.
Do you have a hard time dealing with your emotions? How do you deal with them today?
So I have routines, quite strong routines that I've grew over time, and I've got a morning routine, a nighttime routine. So my morning routine includes some exercise, it includes gratitude, it includes journaling. I set intentions for the day. I write down three tasks that I want to achieve, and I'm very structured and have a schedule and a plan. And then at the end of the day, I'll like write down what wins I've had in the day and what things I've learned and lessons and meditation. Meditation's helped me massively with my emotions, because as soon as I used to have a thought, I used to act on it. And now I know that it doesn't matter what I think, I've got the ability to change what comes next. I've got the ability to rethink it or reframe the thought and make it into a positive, rather than it having to be a very reactive behaviour. And I've learned not to react, just accept. And one of my biggest triggers has always been other people and what they see or how they see it. And now I totally believe that doesn't matter what anybody else says or sees, it's none of my business. So it removes the trigger. It removes the impact that that person or them people or what anybody else sees. It doesn't affect us in an emotional way anymore, because that's their belief, not mine.
Can you tell me how you surrender today and what that looks like?
So every morning, part of my morning routine, I'll meditate and I just ask for to be shown the right way and hand anything over that's kind of bothering us as such. You know, I'll pass it over in my morning meditation. I'm not a big prayer. I don't pray a lot, but I believe I get me contact, my spiritual contact through meditation, and I do that every single morning and most nights. And if I have a period throughout the day where I'm finding it a little bit challenging, then I'll do more meditation then as well.
So when you say meditation throughout the day, if you come up against something challenging, when you meditate, does that, I don't know if it's a language thing, does that mean prayer or does that mean like silent meditation?
No, silent meditation. So for me, meditation's about, it's about sitting peacefully, acknowledging thoughts, acknowledging things that come into your head, and being able to remove the power of them, remove the power of the thought, so that I can choose a different response.
So if you don't mind, I have a couple more questions. What is your ongoing relationship with your higher power, or how has it changed over the past couple of years?
Initially, I really, really struggled to grasp a higher power. I thought it was all a bit nonsense. And that was probably about the first 6 months of being in recovery. And then I started working in the steps. And when I started working the steps, I think it was put to us in a different way. I struggled with the word God. And then when I started working the steps, it was put to us that even if you don't believe in God, just believe that if you do the right thing, then if you do the next right thing, then the right thing will happen. You know, I'm a firm believer in everything happens for a reason, but I'd never really understood higher power. But now it's faith for me. You know, I use the word faith all the time, and I know that there's so much stuff out there that I'm not in control of, that'll happen. Some things good, some things bad, but if I'm doing the right thing and I'm making sure that I can put my head on a pillow tonight, knowing I've done everything I can to the best of my ability, then I've got to learn to accept that what'll be will be.
Final question for the gambler or the drug addict or the alcoholic still listening. What would you like to say? Perhaps they're still out there suffering. Perhaps they've relapsed. Perhaps they've never experienced sobriety.
My biggest message or my biggest thing to anybody is, if you're doing it alone, you're doing it wrong. So find yourself a group of people that you can relate to and you can connect to, who are on a similar journey that you want to go on. Find the people that have got the lived experience and stay close by to them.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.